This is Gil Manser welcoming you to Word by Word Conversations with Writers on KRCB 91.1 FM or streaming online at krcb.org. Tonight's guests are two collaborative writing teams who will be featured at the 11th Annual Sonoma County Book Festival in downtown Santa Rosa on Saturday, September 24th. Belva Davis and her co-author Vicki Haddock will share the secrets of writing the memoir Never in My Wildest Dreams, A Black Woman's Life in Journalism, while mystery novelists Lisa Lutz and David Hayward have no secrets. They include their testy back-and-forth exchanges in between the chapters of their mystery novel, Heads You Lose. As the first black female TV journalist in the West, Belva Davis helped change the face and focus of TV news. Born to a 14-year-old Louisiana laundress during the Great Depression, raised in the crowded projects of Oakland, confronted by racism and abuse, it has been an amazing odyssey for Davis. She has won 8 local Emmys, a number of Lifetime Achievement Awards, including honors from the International Women's Media Foundation, the National Association of Black Journalists, and the Northern California chapter of the National Association of Television Arts and Sciences. Davis continues to host a weekly news roundtable and special reports at San Francisco's KQED-TV. Belva's co-author is Vicki Haddock. In her 3 decades as a journalist in the Bay Area, Haddock has been a political reporter, a general assignment reporter. She's written about science, travel, and health. A freelancer, she had appeared on Davis's show This Week in Northern California, but did not know her well personally when she was tapped to work with Davis on her autobiography. Lisa Lutz and David Hayward were kind of a couple over a decade ago, but now pursue other interests. Known for her comedic Spellman series of crime novels, Lutz has been nominated for the Edgar, Anthony, and McCavity Awards. David Hayward has an MFA in poetry from the University of California, has won the Pushcart Prize, and, as is mentioned several times in Heads You Lose, his work has appeared in Harper's Magazine. Belva, Vicki, Lisa, and David, I want to welcome you to Word by Word.
Thank you.
Thanks, Gil.
Thank you.
I noticed that we're talking to Belva and Vicki, and I noticed that they call your book a memoir, but the way it's structured, with you beginning with your birth, essentially, it's really more like an autobiography. But since it's written with a collaborator, is it auto?
Well, I wish it was that elegant, but it is.
What you just said.
I was told that if I were writing an autobiography, I would have to do notes and all kinds of other little things that when you call it history as known to me through my experience, you'd have to do any of that.
So it's a memoir.
It's a memoir.
It's what you recall. Yes. Helped by scrapbooks and videotape and audio recordings.
And Vicki's great sense of research.
So we're going to talk to Vicki and Belva first because you are the collaborative team who are the most traditional in the room tonight. And you had a very short time period, 5 months to create an 80,000-word piece. And how was this presented? How did you jump in with both feet?
Well, we knew from the beginning that we had to be really disciplined about how we approached it. And so Belva and I drafted a chapter outline. Each week we focused on each chapter in consecutive order, just pretty much going chronologically with the exception of the first chapter. And we focused on that for the week. So we did the interviews, writing, editing, changing, whatever, and we finished, and there wasn't really much looking back.
So as a setup, you open the book with Belva and her colleague Louis Freeman at the 1964 Republican Convention at the Cow Palace in San Francisco. Since you couldn't get media passes, you were sitting high up in the bleachers and recording with a bulky portable tape recorder. Things went relatively well on the first day, but tell us what happened on the second day.
On that day, former President Eisenhower made a speech that motivated the right, and the place just fell apart.
Now, as I recall in the book, you said it was ad-lib parts added to the speech.
Right. He had a well-written speech. In fact, I've read the speech many times. And a well-written speech. And then he inserted some words about people on the street with switchblade knives, who later then expect to fall on the mercy of the court because of their poor childhood experiences, which to encode was black youth on the street with knives and asking for pity on the courts. And he was speaking out against that. And that was what this crowd sort of, it was like Flint, you know, that he'd struck a match to something. And they sort of went wild. And then when we were discovered, we became the focus.
Hey, look up there. Look at UCS.
Yes. Right. And so there were those yells. And then soon they were throwing things at us, whatever they had in their hands, whether it was program books or paper or wrappers
or mustard-covered hot dogs or occasionally a bottle.
Right,
which shattered on next to you.
Right. And so Lewis and I really tried to be the brave ones. He is really a very dignified person. He was determined that we were not going to appear to have been driven out of there. So we slowly wrapped our cords and put our equipment together and started out. And that meant we had to pass the crowd. And those were scary moments.
Yes.
And when a bottle got too close, I started to was on the verge of crying. My lips were quivering. And as we were going, as I said, Lewis was determined we were going to leave with all the dignity we could. And so he whispered under his breath to me that if you cry, I will break your legs. Mm. Just like that. And it was so funny that I started to laugh, or smile at least, if not laugh.
Right.
And we walked the gauntlet. We got out of there safely. And in our ride home was when I recognized fully the power of the media, because the mainstream media had been also treated very poorly. But they had they were changing America.
That's the one John Chancellor was hustled out of the room.
Absolutely,
right.
was placed under arrest at that same conference. And but before that, you have to remember the media had covered Martin Luther King in the South. They'd covered the demonstrations. They'd given power to the unrest of the underprivileged and Black Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said, I want to be one of those guys. It was going to be a while before that happened, but it was a resolve, a recognition of that power, I think, that kept me motivated because they were changing the country.
Well, the media is a powerful influence for good or evil.
Yes.
Yes. So, Vicki, is this what happened? Would she tell you an excerpt and you'd hastily write it down? Or what was the process?
Well, it was this newfangled thing called a digital recorder,
actually. Oh, yeah. I have a couple of those, actually. Right.
We would talk about things. And, I think in terms of the writing process, Belva had not really stopped to recall in great detail a lot of things from her past that she found particularly difficult or painful. That's not her style. This is not somebody who spent hours in therapy regurgitating everything that she's gone through. Her survival strategy, I think, has just been keep busy, keep one foot in front of the other.
Busy.
Right, and keep reaching higher, and it's why she's been able to climb as amazingly high as she has. But so I think trying to evoke those memories in enough detail to really make them come alive was what we focused a lot of our discussions on. And then I would go back and listen to the recording, and the goal was to capture her voice as much as I could, and then she would go through whatever I put together. And
well, there's also a part that Vicki missed, thank God. I'd spent 4 years working on this project and had thought, which had given me the opportunity to think through and write, which I did. And some of that is what allowed me to be able to be expressive in a way that I thought represented the experiences that I was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And
because you were not just being and speaking for yourself.
No. I'd spent many days struggling with this whole process of what should be on paper and what should be not on paper. And if she had to overcome anything, it was my hesitation to not have those things that I had decided not to include to be then brought forward and added and stretched and made maybe a little bit more honest than I might have chosen in the original writing.
Well, we will come back to that because I have an excerpt I'm going to read from or have you read from, and then that brings that up. There's this antipathy that comes across on the page there.
Yeah.
Dave and Lisa, to change things entirely here from going to a small town somewhere up by this beautiful mountain in Northern California. And how did this start? Did it start the way it starts in the book where you wrote a note to David and said, hey, by the way, you doing anything for the next 6 months?
No, it was a phone call. I had the idea of a collaboration, of two people collaborating and exposing the beams of the collaboration. And
so that was in the original concept, was that you would have these
absolutely
back and forth.
Yes,
right.
I mean, the way the book is, just other than Dave's chapters, is exactly how I intended it to be.
Right.
So I wanted a book.
Other than Dave's chapters.
Well, I thought Dave would write the chapters a certain way, and he wrote them a different way, and we had to adjust. Both of us had to adjust. But the premise of the book was what I was envisioned completely, that it would, I would write the odd number chapters, Dave would write the even number chapters, and then we'd leave notes for each other in between. And it was, the germ of the idea was about a collaboration gone wrong. I had heard of and met many men in the crime writing community who collaborate on novels together, and they're very much alpha males. And it just never really, I couldn't believe how they would get along afterwards. So that was what interested me.
Right. What's your take on this, Dave?
Well, I think Lisa envisioned it as moving in a much smoother procession, chapter to chapter. So she had this initial vision for the book, but it ended up going somewhere, I don't know, entirely different.
Actually, I think that what I thought would be different was the way in which our differences would clash. So
you were seeing the difference of the personalities?
No, I was seeing the difference in how we wanted the story to go, not in the difference more in sort of our writing styles and our interest in narrative.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it became much more, like, sort of intellectual in some sense. Like, Dave's a poet, you
right.
know, and he's into the details, and he's never written, correct me if I'm wrong, but you've never written a short story before, or have you?
A short story, yeah, but never a long piece of fiction.
Did something happen in the short story?
Yes.
Or was it just some guy sitting around thinking?
A little bit happened.
At a bar or coffee shop, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, the differences ended up being about how we interpreted the crime novel itself.
And as soon as we had a conflict like that, which was genuine, it was based on my genuine inability or reluctance to move the story forward. We sort of played it up so that in my chapters, I'm going more and more into the backstory of this fictional
characterization.
Town, where Lisa is relentlessly moving the story forward and killing off characters, most of which are mine.
Some of whom come back to life. It's sort of like a soap opera, by the way.
Technically, that was not allowed, but we found ways around that.
They didn't quite die. Sorry.
Right. It's
we thought they
debatable.
Were dead.
Yeah. So.
I thought they were dead.
Anyway, what happened? Well, you thought they were dead. You killed them off, and there he is in a hospital bed in the next chapter, right?
Modern medicine.
No, it's. I just saw this happen. A friend's visiting, and he turned on this soap opera, and that's exactly all these people we thought were dead from, or I don't watch it, but he thought were dead, have all of a sudden reappeared in the last, because it's 2 weeks left of the show or something. So
yeah, I was surprised how much soap opera watching Dave had done.
Why? The character, that's all he does is watch very interesting, arcane TV shows I've never watched.
Well, one of the great things about this project, as someone who's never written a long piece of fiction before, I had this built-in deadline every couple of weeks, and it was actually about the same length of time as Belva and Vicky's book.
So did you have this sold already and a timeline to be done?
No. I mean, the issue for me was that I was taking a break from a series of novels that were doing well, and then I said, I need to try something else.
And you had so much time to do it.
No. It was more like I wrote it on spec, but I knew that, you know, with a crime writer, they really expect one book a year. Mm-hmm. So I knew that if it didn't work, I didn't really have time to waste. So that's why I was – one of the reasons why I was so – strict with Dave on the deadline.
Anyway, it's a fascinating. It's the story itself is a murder mystery in the traditional sense, where you know something happens and then they begin. The amateur sleuths try to figure it out. In this case, it's a brother and sister who raise pot for their main profession and money, and they just decide to look into it themselves. And they go and talk to the sheriff. She goes and talks to the sheriff frequently and doesn't tell him anything. Mostly trying to find out information, and he's off interviewing his old friends and cronies in various different states of consciousness. Fair, yeah. And using long words or very arcane words.
Well, it's relatively.
Yeah, not to a poet.
Yeah,
they write.
Right.
So we got two entirely different processes going on here. We've got one in the traditional mode, one specifically in the non-traditional mode, where one of the authors in the collaborative venture is pulling out her hair, figuratively, right? Over what's happening.
Or literally.
Or literally.
Okay. Both authors are pulling their hair out.
So, Belva and Vicky, did you have any pulling your hair things, or did it go much smoother?
No, I at least I don't think so. I wasn't aware of it. I think Vicky was also the beneficiary of my having to try to collaborate with two other people where it didn't work.
Ah, you know, so this is, was this the third on this same book?
Well, we didn't get nearly a book, but we got started.
But the same project, we'll
yes,
call it.
The same yes. project. And, I knew from the very beginning that the book that I wanted needed to have my heart and soul. But as I said to Vicky when she started to work with me, my words needed to be sent to finishing school, or my book, or my outline.
Your words needed to be sent to finishing school.
Those are the very words I use.
I feel that way all the time.
I actually suspect that I might be the third or fourth co-author Lisa tried for this book. She won't admit to that.
She doesn't. Yeah. She wouldn't name names, though. Well, let's go back to Belva's book, Never in My Wildest Dreams, which is a very interesting title. Where did it come from?
I wish I knew, but I had it. How did we?
You had it when I
had
met.
It. Yeah, it, I mean, I think only because it's so honest. Mm-hmm. Because never in my wildest dreams, coming from where I came from, in a small town in Louisiana, born in the Depression, was I, and without a college degree, mm-hmm. who had carved out this career in media.
Right.
It's doing pretty well at it. Never in my wildest dreams did I think I could reach those heights. And it had all been so gradual, till it almost was a surprise. I mean, I had started working for black newspapers, black program radio stations, totally segregated media.
Right.
And then soon I was into major market media, expected to be all things to all people, mm-hmm. having lived a life that was pretty much defined by racism. So there was no reason for me to have this dream of being, you know, the first black woman in the West on TV. There was no foundation.
No. Well, basically reading, you were a person who was, as you said, sort of the unwanted baggage mm-hmm. in the family, who was shuffled around almost like you were stuck in an attic somewhere mm-hmm. and forgotten, and yeah. somebody'd take care of you this week, and then something would happen. You'd go someone else for a couple months, and et cetera, slept on many floors, on many pallets.
Yes.
Had horrifying experiences in your living situation and growing up situation, mm-hmm. and felt racism in all sorts of ways, mm-hmm. even after you moved to Oakland, and maybe even more so there because you expected it would be different. There's one story you told, however, and I'd like to have you share that with us, about when you were on the bowling team.
I call that my lesson in the power of one. Mm-hmm. I was a student at Berkeley High, and it was at a time when there were not a lot of students like me at Berkeley High.
One good best friend, however.
Yes, very good. And in any case, I decided to go out for the basketball team. Well, I'm 5'1", and I think I weighed about 105 pounds then. Well, pretty soon it was very evident that was not where I was supposed to be.
Right.
And so my gym teacher suggested, why not try bowling? I never bowled in my life, but I did. And I was pretty good. I mean, I could bowl 300. Wanted to be the best at
whatever. See, you didn't put that in the book.
I was very good. In fact, I used to bowl with my husband until I beat him so much that I thought, if I'm going to get this guy as a husband, I better stop this bowling stuff.
It's the 5-1 secret. You know, you're closer to the ball or something. Yeah.
I think you paid me to keep the 300 out of the book so Bill wouldn't find out.
But in any case, I bowled there with the Berkeley High bowling team until one Saturday. I decided I wanted to.
Now, the rest of the team is all white girls from the Hill, basically.
Or guys. I mean, they need to bowl. Okay. And so anyway, went down to the bowling alley, the Berkeley Bowl, with my money that I saved from working at the Five and Dime in South Berkeley, and went up to the counter and tried to rent bowling shoes and a bowling ball. Was ignored for quite a long and embarrassing time. Soon was told by the man behind the counter that I couldn't bowl there. And I just... You know, now I caught me off guard, couldn't understand why not. And so I kept insisting because I had the money to pay for it. And to me, if you have the money to pay for it, at that, I should have been able
to. Berkeley,
do it. In Berkeley,
certainly.
Right.
Right.
Anyway, it didn't happen. So I decided I'd do, this is sort of like my life, I'd do what I could at the best I could. And so I drew the size of a bowling alley on the concrete driveway near my home. And I took canned goods from my mom's shelf, my aunt's, and I use them as bowling balls and bowling pins, the larger cans for the balls and smaller cans for the pins. And I was practicing in my driveway when one of my teachers came by, stopped her car at King and Ashby, came back to my house and asked what I was doing. And I told her I was practicing. And pretty embarrassing. She went away. And
you told her why you were practicing there.
Yes, I did. And she, when I told her what had happened, then she said, and I remember this clearly, we'll see about that. And she left. Mm-hmm. And later she came to me and she said, you can bowl at the Berkeley Bowl anytime you want. And I stopped and she says, no, you can bowl anytime you would like. Then I found out that she'd gone to our principal, Mr. Laton, and she told him what had happened. He had called the owner of the bowling alley and threatened to pull all the Berkeley bowling team out of their alley if I could not bowl there when I wanted to. Mm-hmm. And so that's what happened. And that's how the Berkeley Bowl became an integrated place. And one would never think that about Berkeley, that anyone would have to suffer or teen that kind of embarrassment.
What was this
to
year?
To bowl.
The year of this was...
That would have probably been like 1950.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And then she said, and you don't have to worry. All of your bowling in the future is on me because you're so good.
Because it cost money to rent the shoes and the alley.
Yes, and it was a struggle. That's why I had a job.
Right.
So that I'd have money. And so I've always thought of that as one woman quietly working the system and getting major results that changed a situation and an opportunity for a whole class of people. And I used it as a model throughout my life to think, yes, one person can change things. At least that changed my life.
That certainly did. And in your novel, David and Lisa, you had one person who changed things, some murder person who dropped a body off in front of the brother and sister's place without a head.
That was a great transition.
Did you like that?
Segway.
I feel like we should leave.
Your story's not going to match, is it? No.
No,
well.
Yeah. Although, interestingly, Bill Cosby also wrote the foreword to our book.
And he lived on a houseboat and used to know him and go visit, right? Right. Funny thing. No, seriously, where did the headless body? Because that wasn't the title at the time. You didn't have your head.
That's I think that's all we had to start with is Lisa had this idea of.
You'd done the first chapter already?
Yeah, before the chapter was written, I knew that part of it. That there would be a headless body dropped on someone's driveway. I mean, I was really all my other quote unquote crime novels had no murder in them, and so I was very eager to get a murder in right away.
In the Agatha Christie style, where you not only have one, but you have several when I don't know why they ever invite those ladies in that, you know, the gentleman with the mustache, too, because as soon as they appear, more murders happen. You notice
right,
that?
But we didn't invite them.
No.
And I especially didn't invite some of these characters.
No.
And I rescinded their invitation immediately.
You did. You did your best anyway. Right. Right.
Yeah.
The, like, we have, we'd only have one gimpy stripper with a pole dancer who was injured on the job. But we have two.
No, there's only one.
No, there's reference to another one.
Yeah. I only acknowledge one.
Okay. You can see how this is still working, right? Does everyone get the impression?
I don't know if this microphone is picking up my eye roll.
Well, that's the grinding noise we're hearing, yes. Okay, so let's take this. Lisa, you can. It's funny because when you read things, you have impressions. I figured Lisa was, you know, this big Zoftic type that, you know, would play in the... I don't know, Lord of the Rings or something, you know, with higher than a, you know, the mountain kind of person, and she's not. So anyway. Oh, well.
I'm small and squirrely.
That's it, squirrely. Woof. Okay, so moving on back to Bill.
I want defense over here.
Okay, David, defense.
There are always Dave sympathizers in the mix.
Well, it's, Lisa had the first chapter, and it became clear that I was going to have to kind of stake out my own part of the book and make sure that it was more than just a relentless series of brutal murders.
Mm-hmm.
Like Lisa, as you've heard, had a lot of pent-up aggression.
Right. But she didn't have murders in her other books.
Right.
Right.
I wouldn't go that far.
So I felt like it was my responsibility to the reader to provide a somewhat more contemplative experience.
Can you hear my eye roll?
Yeah. Right. That sound.
But the whole book is sort of that punch, counterpunch, chapter to chapter.
Well, so you know that it works well because of that. I mean, it's much more fun to read than if there was a traditional, you'd laid out 18 chapters and this was going to happen here, and he followed right along.
No, I didn't want him to follow along. I just wanted him to not follow along in different ways, I think.
Oh.
I eventually adjusted to how he didn't follow along.
Right. It's interesting because they're way up in this, you know, in the boonies, we'll call it, although the people up there probably don't think so, but it's a long distance between communities. Fair? 50 miles, 20 miles.
Yeah.
And they just, hey, let's go visit, let's go have dinner down the road. And it's, you know, a 50-mile drive kind of thing.
But there's no traffic.
That's true. Well, very little. Well, this time of year there wasn't. Right. No snow to bury the bodies. Back to the other two collaborators in the room. There are certain things. You were mentioning this earlier. There is a scene shortly after you have come to San Francisco and you have been asked to write for Jet Magazine as a kind of a stringer, I guess we'll call it. Is that fair?
Mm-hmm.
For the local West Coast, you know, what's happening in the Bay Area kind of thing. And that really was what started your career.
Right.
But your husband, who you had married just out of high school, because he asked, I guess, is my impression, and then he went into the service and you'd been stationed in Washington, D.C. and worked as a clerk typist on some super secret projects that we really still don't know about because you're not allowed to talk. And but then you come back to the San Francisco Bay Area, and he becomes starts working in the shipyards. Is that right?
Yes.
And he is not overjoyed with you having a career that's different than—
Understatement.
Yeah. So— Is this something you want to talk about or not?
Not necessarily.
Okay.
I mean, it's a phase of life. I think it's growing up. I think when kids get married right out of high school, which is what happened,
mm-hmm.
So especially if you marry the person who lives next door to you,
right.
One of these days you might grow up. And
because he was going into the service was kind of the precipitating reason for timing.
Absolutely. And as you start to mature and really realize who you are, or begin to realize it as you're growing up,
mm-hmm.
you then develop a personality and a list of things you like and don't like. And I think that's exactly what happened to me. More exposure I had to grown-ups and grown-up situations, the more I saw myself living a different kind of life.
Now, the roles that were outlined in the 1950s were pretty well laid out for men and, you know, husband and wife especially. Would you agree?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, my ex-husband at that time, mm-hmm. Did not believe that his wife should wear short skirts, nor should she dance with men, not her husband.
Right.
I mean, he had a lot of Victorian attitudes about mm-hmm. the place mm-hmm. of a woman. And also, he didn't believe in divorce.
Mm-hmm.
So when I decided the marriage...
Which was kind of an interesting thing, because there certainly the relationships in the rest of your family, the men had come and gone for different periods of time. You know, sometimes they'd hang around, and then your mother, in fact, took off one night and left you alone and with your dad and lots of other relatives in a very crowded house.
And again, because, you know, she was a mother by the time she was 15.
Mm-hmm.
So I later, in trying to understand a lot of things about my life, which is what why I told you it took so many years to work
right.
through all
right.
of these various layers of things, realized that she probably, too, at some point began to become an adult and know what she wanted in life and what she didn't. And my dad was a brilliant guy, but he was very, very domineering.
Mm-hmm. Now, Vicki, when you were writing this first 40 pages, which is a very personal, well, any part of the book, actually, but this is, you know, this is the psychological educator in me trying to, you know, wrestle with this. To say that you felt unwanted is probably too kind.
Yeah, I think so.
And that comes across on the page. Now, is this Belva's words, or is this your prodding, or did you want her to give more, or did she do it automatically? So, Vicki, what? In other words, was it difficult to write this part?
I think the writing was somewhat difficult because, I mean, Belva's right. A part of her knew that she had to be honest about a lot of things that she wouldn't necessarily jump at the chance to be honest about in public.
Mm-hmm.
I think that she had...
Well, so let me ask the question. Mm-hmm. Why are these chapters so important to be as honest as they are?
Well, I think that's what a memoir is. It's your story.
Mm-hmm.
And not all of it is, you know,
peaches and cream. Right.
Right. Rainbow experiences. And in addition to that, I felt compelled, having been as fortunate as I have been in life, to share these tough parts for the many youngsters who came from and are still coming from neighborhoods like I grew up
mm-hmm,
in,
mm-hmm.
and sometimes lose the spirit to fight and to fight back and to work as hard as they can to realize their own dreams. And I wanted this to be an example to them of someone who had gone through. In fact, when I started to speak about this, I wrote a list of all the stereotypical things that are supposed to contribute to failure in life. You know, born to a teen mom, you know, no college degree, living in the projects. I mean, you name them. And when I used to go to so-called disadvantaged schools where mm-hmm. kids were having problems, mm-hmm. I would challenge them to name me one stereotype that I haven't experienced that you're going through, and let's talk about it.
Right,
and those have been some great experiences with kids when they've responded that way. So it was important to share, but it was really hard. And a lot of See, it wasn't that I didn't write about it at all. I just didn't write. I learned this thing from Maya Angelou, who, when I was talking about the pain of this,
mm-hmm.
and I said this before, she said, "Honey, just tell the truth, mm-hmm. just not too much of it." And it was up to Vicki to get the of it out
right.
as far
right.
as I go.
Right, right. Well.
And I think one of the things that we've appreciated about people who've read the book is that even people who had known Belva for years and years and worked alongside her and felt like they really knew Belva Davis
mm-hmm.
read this book. And as Phil Bronstein said, I'm astonished to read this and realize how much of the factors that influenced your life I knew nothing of. So I think most people in the Bay Area who grew up when Belva was in journalism, had an impression of her as this extremely poised, successful, capable woman who seemed to kind of float
well,
on
Bill
air.
Bill Cosby's wife thought so.
Yes.
Because she writes
and,
that.
And not to take away from that, because actually Belvitt is that.
Right.
But I think they're taken aback to discover that her upbringing was probably not that that vision that they had. Certainly not idyllic, not by a long shot. And yet, look at what she's done.
Right. You are listening to Word by Word Conversations with Writers on KRCB 91.1 FM. Let's rejoin Belva Davis and her co-author, Vicki Haddock, as they continue sharing the secrets of writing the memoir, Never in My Wildest Dreams, A Black Woman's Life in Journalism. While mystery novelist Lisa Lutz and David Hayward continue their testy back-and-forth exchanges we read about between chapters of their mystery novel, Heads You Lose. Well, there are two interesting things that happen. I mean, there's so many things, interesting things that happen in your young life, but two really major influences. One is the community house, the community center that was founded and you begin to go to and you found a safe place to be and explore so many different things, arts and letters and, you know, dances and et cetera, et cetera. A cultural center for your community, which – you know, unfortunately, has kind of disappeared in today.
And that was my speak out.
That's right.
For the importance of people who work with children who are in areas where they don't have the opportunity to do things that children growing up in middle-class households consider just part of, you know, their normal lives.
Mm-hmm.
I was introduced to that by the rec leader, very wonderful woman who really pointed a lot of people to a road of success.
And you mentioned some of them, you know,
Bill
whose
Russell
names we
one,
right,
yeah.
right, whose names we recognize.
The
other thing that happened is you obviously there is something within you because you were admitted to San Francisco State as a senior in high school, but you didn't get the applications in time to get the scholarship, so you needed $300, and you went to your father and said, "This is my opportunity. I desperately need this money. I know." You know, it would be a significant sacrifice for you to do so. And he turns to you and says, "Yes, sweetie, no."
I said no, because I was the first to graduate from high school.
Right.
So many members of my family consider that a real benchmark. And my father worked for the Navy, and he knew that I could get a job as a typist.
Mm-hmm.
And he thought that was about as much as I should ask for out of life. So he did not want to participate in helping me to go farther.
Now, this is an interesting question because as I read that, do you think of yourself as a black person or a woman first?
Oh, boy, is that – well, it's impossible to walk around with brown streak skin and have people just forget it.
Right, right. Because it's visible.
It's visible.
But just as your gender is.
Yes, just as my gender. But that is – that's a battle fought with a different set of rules. With women not of color,
mm-hmm.
there are certain privileges that they have enjoyed. Honestly, the fight for equality is just as serious. But one would tend to see an attractive, blue-eyed blonde without quite the stereotypical hostility you see when you see color. So color brings up images cultivated to be negative over the years.
Right.
Whereas gender has happened, and it's been unfair to women because some are so capable to go far beyond what is expected of them.
Well, I was thinking in the historic time, the early 50s, mm-hmm. is when many women had gone to work and were the support of the family in many ways because their husbands were away at war. They were, bringing in money and taking care of the kids and the grandparents, et cetera, et cetera. And then all of a sudden, that's kind of, pulled away. And so there's a very limited choice of what a woman could do. And secretary was one, nurse another, teacher another. And you went into the secretary mold, which, where did you learn to write?
I learned to write just by writing. I mean, starting with the writing as a stringer, my whole thing was to capture whatever the moments that were going to be put into Jet Magazine.
Right.
Never got a byline, but I was lucky to get – but I had a wonderful editor who worked with me week after week in terms of just helping me develop my thoughts mm-hmm. clearly mm-hmm. To be clear in what I wanted as the payoff to whatever I was saying, and there had to be a payoff. There had to be a reason to read that line, he'd say. Why do I want to read this? Telling me that a good time was had by all does not work. You have to tell me what
or
happened.
Or just mentioning the people who were there.
Right, right. That's not right. enough. So I learned just by doing, but because I didn't and don't have, you know, college background, this is what I meant about, going to finishing school. I knew that grammar and spelling were going to be my Waterloo. Mm-hmm. And had tried enough, captured great ideas, but not said in a way that was going to get the kind of prizes that these two young people
well, you've have got, already you've, accumulated. You've got a whole wall of prizes,
well, that's
I'm
for
sure.
a different kind of work. That's yeah, not about well, writing books, yeah.
I never won a prize.
No, she was nominated.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Dave won.
Dave won a push cart.
Although you have faced similar challenges with your spelling and grammar.
That's
right,
true.
Right.
Yeah.
Are you going to do another book together, Dave and Lisa?
Probably not.
There would have to be some negotiation first.
Maybe you could write the first chapter and then invite her.
And I'd say, no, thank you very much.
You don't really, because it's a fun read.
I think actually there has to be a demand for that, and there wasn't much of one.
So has this been well received by people? Or are they looking at it and not sure what it is?
I think a lot of people are confused.
We've had a lot of nice reviews.
Yeah.
And but I think one thing that's fair to say is that Lisa's longtime fans mm-hmm. of her book, The Spellman mm-hmm. series, mm-hmm. they didn't automatically buy it and get into it. Is that
they
fair
were
to say?
Really, really yeah. baffled by it. Yeah. And they were just annoyed that I didn't write another Spellman book.
Well, it's a very intellectual book, in a sense.
Why, thank you.
Yeah, because it makes you think.
But the Spellmans aren't dumb. I just want
no,
to
no,
say
no,
that.
No, I didn't say but, it. I didn't mean that. But yeah, it's a no. different kind of a, you know, they're formulaic in a sense. And this is definitely not that, because you it's almost like the two of you decide, well, I'm going to head off to the right, and you say, no, 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 come back, and then I'm going to go to the left because you went to the right.
I think some of the – well, we hoped – or I hope that some of the interest in reading the book is how are they going to pull this off, or how are they going to keep this thing on the rails?
Like, right.
We kind of wanted it to be always veering on the edge of just dissolving into – bitter chaos.
Now, you mentioned off air that you had done some editing or rewrites on this. This is not exactly the rough draft that it appears to be.
I think people misunderstand the book in some sense. It's a very calculated venture, and it was edited as carefully as any of my other books have been edited, which is, you know, quite a bit. I mean, we had to figure out a balance, and while we may seem very acerbic on the page in our interactions with one another, they were much worse in the first draft. And our editor was just like, people are going to hate you if we don't scale it back a bit. So we had to do a lot of work on that. And we also had to sort of, we still had to work on the story. I mean, the story still had to, you know, be satisfying.
You had to have someone at the end say, so-and-so did right. this such and such to so-and-so, right. and this is what happened after that. And when, have us understand that.
Right. When we started writing, we actually were writing it pretty much as it's presented, which is Lisa writes a chapter. I have no idea what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. She has no idea what I'm going to write in my chapter. Mm-hmm. She has to go with it. And we discovered about 3 or 4 chapters in that we would just kill each other if we kept doing it that way because we were, you know, just stepping
well,
on key
you almost
points
do, and, or the brother and sister almost do. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, you were alter egos on the page as the brother and sister, essentially.
Pretty much. Yeah. And we knew it would turn out that way, where Paul, the brother, is the stand-in for me.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, I agree. That's one thing we agree on.
Hey.
Right on.
Yay. By the way, are you going to be on the same panel?
Yes, we're on the mystery panel.
You're on the mystery panel.
We'll be on the same panel.
That would be, I'm going to recommend that people go and see you, if nothing else, to just chuckle from the audience when you get on the same stage, because it should be as entertaining as it is here.
Well, I'm just concerned that people are going to confuse our two books.
Yeah.
I know.
Well, we're going to talking about murders. My gosh, you've got several murders in this book. Yeah, see, do you like that segue?
Nice.
Pretty good, huh?
We didn't know how you'd pull this off.
Well, see, we can do collaboration later. No, seriously, there are some things that happen that you reported on that are watershed events, certainly in the San Francisco Bay Area. Yeah. One of the men you talk about in a certain way is someone who I'd actually met, is Jim Jones. And I was in Los Angeles and was introduced to him by the bishop of the AME church, who thought he was a great guy because he was doing so much for the community. And you start out with a woman who has just decided to donate her house to the temple, the People's Temple. And tell us about that experience and this man.
I want you to read the book, so I'm not going to tell you too much about it. But the woman that you're talking about who was giving her house to Jim Jones was my housekeeper. Mm-hmm. She was taking care of my children.
Right.
And it was because of this feeling in not only the San Francisco community but wherever, Jim Jones was saying the right thing about equality and about justice and about integration. He was saying all the things we were pleading and wanting to hear. Mm-hmm. So when people heard these things, they adopted it as the truth, not knowing what was going on within that community. And this woman was placed in my house, mm-hmm. because my husband was a TV news reporter and I was a news reporter, because he was so paranoid he thought she could help him with evidence of any investigation or any downfall coming, so that he would be prepared. And he started to get inklings of that,
She was placed in your house. Say that again.
She was placed in my house
to
gather information,
right,
if possible. She would collect paper trash from our house that they would go through in case there was something in it about any investigation of Jones, because the word started to creep out, mm-hmm. that there were problems. And we certainly thought there was when we discovered that she was as high up,
right,
in the organization as she was. But no, these were turbulent times. And I think the privilege I have is being able to tell the story of those times through our experiences. Not only that, but, you know, the murder of Mira Moscone and Harvey Milk and the story of the Black Panther Party, mm-hmm. in a different way from which you may have heard it before. So I tried to tell stories that you can research and may be familiar to you. But when you do, I hope that Vicki has done the correct job that we think she has. You can place my story into the historical story that you're going to read, and the facts will come out the same.
Maya Angelou has a quote that I'm going to say here. No people can say they understand the times in which they have lived unless they have read this book. Now, I'm going to say that again. No people can say they understand the times in which they have lived unless they have read this book. And I, you know, was born and raised in the Bay Area, and I know all these events. And as you say, they're presented in a different light with backstory that I was completely unaware of or knew some about. So, Vicki, you must have been like you were writing a murder mystery with the script already written.
I had a blast actually working on this book because I loved the research. It was as I say about journalism, a great way to get other people to pay for your education. You know, you get to go out and learn all this stuff, and it's a living. But also, to be able to, in an extremely limited way because of my own limitations, but to be able to try to understand that unfolding of histories through the eyes of someone who was a different race and lived in a different time.
A different age, too.
Yes.
Yes.
I had read about the 1964 Goldwater Convention. I was 4 when it happened, so
right.
I have no real memory of it myself. But Belva's intense impressions of that convention still struck me, because I did not realize in all that I'd read about that convention what rampant racism there was. And then when I started researching it further and reading Jackie Robinson's accounts and going back and reading old Jet magazines from their reporter who was there at the time, you know, learning about how the KKK was marching outside. And that's just one example, but it
it's not a San Francisco you knew.
No, there in many of these stories, it was an entirely different perspective. And so, you know, I mean, as I said, I was just grateful for the opportunity to sort of view this incredible historical panorama through her eyes. Mm-hmm. It was really fun.
Yeah. It's a very interesting read. It kind of gives you a feeling of being there at the time. Now, that's a tribute to you as one who's lived it and one who helped write how it was to live it. So this is a collaboration which, you know, works in an entirely different way than David and Lisa's collaboration, where you two still like each other.
And they do, too.
But in a different way.
Yes.
That's right. So let's talk about collaboration for the few minutes we have left. Would you recommend this as a way of working, Belva? It helped you with your time on the thing because you really wanted to get it finished. It was the third time attempt. And how did you stumble across someone who you could work with so well?
Well, a guy named Norman Solomon was a guest on my show.
Yes.
Yeah, and he knew about this book, and he lived some of these times. And I, when I told him I was not going to do the book, I quit. This is it. I'm not going any further. This was after the second collaboration failed. Mm-hmm. And I just was not going to do it. And he said, you have to do it. And then all of the people who were in the room for that night show went about trying to help me and the woman who was stepping out of the second collaboration to help us find the right person. Mm-hmm. And so it was a band of women who picked Vicki out. And I figured if Carla and Rachel and so on could all agree that she had the personality, it was going to work. It did.
So you got along with each other quite well.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you worked with an editor or not? No, not really. We've got the eye rolling again. We need the sound effects for this.
I would say we had an extraordinarily light edit. We worked with a copy editor.
Yes.
But yeah, I mean, it was it pretty much is what it was.
It is what it was.
We handed it in, and how many days? It was like the next day or a
couple of days later. It went to the copy editor. Yeah, so it was.
I'm going to suggest you are also going to be. Are you going to be on the same panel together too? Yes.
Yes.
And Vicki,
not the mystery panel though.
No. What panel is this you're going to do?
I don't know. It's 12:45. That's
12:45 on Saturday.
In the library,
the 24th in the library. Okay, that's a nice.
Come on, we'll sign your book.
Right.
Sign your.
Well, not only that, sign the book.
We'll sign
but you
book.
Will find that Belva in person is more interesting than you are on TV.
Thank you.
No, I'm serious. You know what I'm saying? We put on a persona when that camera light goes on, right?
Yes, of course.
Yes.
Yes.
And I've watched I've watched you longer than Bill Cosby has. So, right. We grew up together, sort of, which is marvelous because, I keep seeing, is that Belva Davis over there? Oh, my gosh, what's she doing here? Because I remember you way back in, the day. So I recommend that you go and hear. Are you going to read from your book?
Of course.
Oh, yeah. Okay, because I haven't had you do that intentionally.
Thank you.
I want people to pick this up and read it. And you're going to find yourself just immersed in a time and place. Now, it helps a lot, I think, if you're from the Bay Area, mm-hmm. because you remember, you know, at least it was a headline or not, or it was a third page, you know, editorial or something. But it's a very important book. I will mention you had mentioned earlier, Dave, that Bill Cosby did the intro to your book. Well, he actually has done the intro to this book. It's short and it talks about what a wonderful person you seem to appear on the radio and on TV, and how that was true when he met you. So talk about the heads you lose and did this happen the way it. It's outlined in the book as a title.
Dave came up with the title
after a flip of a coin.
We
had a really bland working title.
Yeah,
and I always felt that there was some obvious title that I just wasn't thinking of, like some correct title for this book that mm-hmm. involves a headless body and a coin toss. somewhere around.
We'll get a crossword clue here,
yeah.
Right?
Yes, yeah. It just occurred to me, like, oh yeah, that's the answer. of course. Uh-huh. And I was really excited and immediately called Lisa, and she was like, meh.
I think that my habit back then was just every time Dave had an idea to just sort of lower his expectations of my reaction. Because he had a lot of ideas that I was really like, wow, where did you come up with that? And so it took me a while to accept it as being awesome.
But that's what makes the book so much fun. I mean, seriously, I mean, from my perspective, it's the wild ideas.
Oh, thanks.
It's the going off in a completely different
direction. There's some wilder ones.
It's the living in the top of an old forest fire tower and being stoned out of your head and all the events that happen there, et cetera, et cetera. The book is called Heads You Lose, a Novel. And it's by Lisa Lutz and David Hayward. And the other one to pick up, about, you know, go to the bookstore and get these. This is called...
Buy both just to freak out the clerk.
Yeah, because they go together. There is a logic to it. The other one is called Never in My Wildest Dreams, A Black Woman's Life in Journalism by Belva Davis with Vicki Haddock. I want to thank all four of you for being here. This has been quite fun.
Thank you.
You have been listening to Word by Word Conversations with Writers on KRCB 91.1 FM, where Belva Davis and her co-author Vicki Haddock shared the secrets of writing the memoir Never in My Wildest Dreams, A Black Woman's Life in Journalism, while mystery novelist Lisa Lutz and David Hayward continue their testy back-and-forth exchanges that we read about between the chapters of their mystery novel, Heads You Lose. Both teams of collaborators will be featured at the 11th Annual Sonoma County Book Festival on Saturday, September 24th in downtown Santa Rosa. Lisa Lutz and David Hayward are on the mystery panel at the La Rosa Restaurant, 500 4th Street at 11:30, while Belva Davis and Vicki Haddock are at the Central Library at 211 E Street at 12:45. So you have 15 minutes to travel between the two venues. Our online engineer for tonight's show is Mark Fuller, with assistance from Kylie, our new intern, and I am your host, Gil Manser. We want to invite you to the next Word by Word Conversations with Writers at 7 o'clock Wednesday evening, October 5th. Until then, I invite you to stop by the KRCB booth at the Sonoma County Book Festival on Saturday, September 24th, in downtown Santa Rosa.